Hello, I'm Ian Anderson-Gray, and this is the Smart ADHD Podcast. Now, if you're a smart creative, entrepreneur, or business owner navigating your life with ADHD, this is the podcast for you. Now, I'm no ADHD expert, but I'm eager to share my story on what I've learned by talking with experts, as well as digging into the personal ADHD stories of successful creatives and entrepreneurs. I was diagnosed at age 46, and it answered so many questions in my life. But of course, that was in many ways only the start of my journey. So let's learn together. Smart stories, smart strategies, smart ADHD. Hello, welcome to episode 6 of the Smart ADHD podcast. Well, this is the second Smart ADHD stories episode. And so last time we had Kerry Jordan going into sharing her story, her life, really navigating life with ADHD. And these episodes are longer, they're more raw, they're unedited, allowing people, creatives, entrepreneurs, business owners, to share their story of how they've navigated their lives with ADHD. And I'm excited to share today's episode, which is with my good friend, Libby Langley. We met back in, quite a long time ago, certainly over 10 years ago. And it's been amazing to hear her story. She was diagnosed with ADHD and autism, which came as a little bit of a shock to us. You'll find out in this episode. So without me gibbering on any longer, here is the episode with Libby Langley. Hello, Libby. Welcome to Smart ADHD. How are you doing?
I'm all right. It's lovely to see you again, and thanks for having me on.
I know. It's kind of weird to be in front of computer screens, because we've met up quite a few times recently over the last few years in person, which is always nice. We've known each other for quite a few years. I was asking this question on Facebook about how I first met people, or when people first met me. And I think it was some kind of mastermind thing, wasn't it, that we met quite a few years ago, and Social Media Marketing World, this big conference in San Diego.
Yeah, the mastermind was run by someone that I met on Twitter, who I first actually saw in the flesh at Social Media Marketing World in 2013. So I think it was when I came back from that we started the in-person stuff. I mean, your business was so different than I guess mine was, and we were obviously younger and less grey and all of that, fewer grey hairs back then. But yeah, it's funny that the most, until recently, until I moved closer to you, the most we've kind of engaged in person has been in the States, which is weird, really.
It is weird, yeah. So obviously, yeah. You're based, like me, in the UK. Mm-hmm. You're not too far geographically from me.
No.
So I'm trying to remember back in those days, what were you doing business-wise that's different? We'll get back into like personal stories in a minute, but tell everyone who's watching and listening what it is that you're currently doing, and compare that with maybe, say, 10 years ago when we first met.
Yeah, well, what I do now is I do business coaching. So I work with very small businesses, one woman predominantly, businesses, to help them be better business owners and to work less, to earn more, and actually enjoy what they've created for themselves, rather than just being on the hamster wheel of a job-like business, which so many people create for themselves. And I see it time and time again. And that's kind of morphed out of my journey, I suppose, really, my own personal journey. And when I first started the business, I focused very much on social media strategy, corporate social media, and teaching people how to use social media, because it was good fun. I started doing that in 2009. It was good fun back then, you know. It was much easier. It was a much sort of simpler place to strategize in. And over the years, I've never been a diehard social media fan. I think it holds a huge part in the world, and it's a fantastic tool that's connected us as a real example. But I don't like I don't like the noise of it, right? So over the years, I've kind of moved more into business as a whole because I love that. You know, I love looking under the bonnet of people's businesses and helping them with their why they're in business, what they want to do, and the numbers and how to make more profit and their marketing as well. But it's, yeah, really, it really interests me. So in the context of the kind of neurodiversity, it's absolutely a special interest of mine as well as my business, I've realized. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a funny thing, isn't it? That so often, like, we find a hobby and then it becomes a business, or business becomes a hobby. There's a lot of people I know who aren't neurodiverse. There's a kind of clear separation between the two. And I try and do that, but I don't always do a very good job. So let's talk about ADHD then. And yes, with you, so we've talked about this a lot. It's not just ADHD with you, you're also diagnosed with autism as well. So you've got the two of them, which is
all the boxes games. Ticked. Yeah.
All the boxes ticked. So when did you first realize you had ADHD and or autism? What's been your journey?
So a couple of years ago, I mean, I guess I was like everyone, and it's a horrible thing to admit, but I know that I'm not alone in this, that society, we kind of thought ADHD was the naughty kids at school, right? The naughty boys at school, and autism was the weird kids at school. You know, I mean, that's just, it's really awful. I really struggle to say that because I'm describing myself, but I think that was kind of, that's kind of what, I don't know, what people thought in general, right? It just wasn't discussed and open and as recognised as it is, particularly in girls and women, as it is now. And a couple of years ago, it must be three years ago now, I'm in a community, a money mindset business growth community. And there are lots of people in that community. It's 99.9% women, and a lot of them are kind of 40 plus, I guess. And there was a lot of conversation in there about ADHD. A few people have been diagnosed, and I'm like, what? And the more I started, I'm like, but you're not a naughty boy. You know, I don't know if I thought anything that literally, but I suppose it kind of piqued my interest because it was surprising, really. And I scrolled all the memes, you know, self-diagnosed through memes, and just knew that kind of this explained so much about my brain and about how I'd lived my life to that point. And I just found the kindness I was able to give myself, and realized that I wasn't a complete failure or a massive disappointment like my my family might have led me to believe. And it was the way that my brain was different. So I was kind of quite comfortable and quite happy with that. And we went to, in early-ish 2023, my husband and I went to a talk about ADHD in Sheffield. And because it was an ADHD audience, everybody was just immediately best friends and talking to each other. And the woman next to me, she said, oh, and you're autistic. And I'm like, excuse me, what? Never had kind of thought, I don't know. Well, I just wasn't looking for any more answers, I suppose. And so she said, well, do these tests. And this is why I think it is. Do these online tests. So I did the online test that she'd recommended. And I was like, whoa, I've scored really highly on these. Ah, so some more things are starting to make sense now. And I paid for a private assessment. And sure enough, I'm like a grade A autistic person. And yeah, that was a real struggle for me, actually. The ADHD, it's not the lack of formal diagnosis. I think it's kind of my interpretation of it. The ADHD manifests itself with me in kind of the energy, the fuel, the brilliant brain, I suppose. And the autism, I was just absolutely knocked for six with that diagnosis. It really impacted me. It impacted my business, but it helped to understand myself better. And I kind of think of them as two sides of my brain, although obviously they're all in a big jumble in my brain. And the autism is kind of it's the structure of the order, but it's the need for safety and understanding. and things to be as I expect them to be. But the ADHD is like that. I am going on the roller coaster as many times as I can. I'm going to buy a new house because I just feel like it. It's that kind of fun side, but also that comes with the, oh, you've bought a new house. Yeah. You know, that sort of, that there's a balance there, but I kind of see them quite differently, and having them both, I think, helps me to meet in the middle, or maybe just be twice as kind of what, I don't know, odd, who knows. And it's really hard to kind of judge yourself, isn't it? And yeah, you'll know this, that in the entrepreneurial community, well, once you start to, you know, your kind of neurodiversity radar starts, you're like, yep, 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 yep. So we're not alone, right? We're in the majority, I think, in the entrepreneurial community, neurodivergent people.
I think you're probably right there. Yeah. And yeah, when you're with people whose brains work differently, I think we just kind of get each other a little bit more, because we're so often we're misunderstood. And it's interesting what you're saying about the ADHD and the autism. It's almost as you're saying, almost as if like the autism kind of tempers the ADHD. There's probably, there's definitely ADHD traits, there's definite autism traits, but there are some traits that are probably a little bit of both. For me, it's interesting. I think I struggle with anxiety, and it's my anxiety that tempers my impulsivity. So the anxiety stops me from doing stupid things sometimes, not all the time. Can you maybe kind of explain a little bit more about this kind of how autism and ADHD works in your brain, and how it kind of works or doesn't work with each other?
I suppose I have no idea. But I suppose to think of, it's so hard to kind of unpick your own brain. It's so hard because it's all you've ever known, right? And when you realise that perhaps it's slightly different to, I don't know, like your family or whoever you kind of example you're brought up to follow, it's kind of quite difficult to do that. But I think for me, like in the business context, it is a really difficult question to answer. But in a business context, like I love being up on stage, right? I love doing keynotes and I love doing talks, and I've done kind of 4 or 5 in the last month or something, which is quite a high number for me. But I love that. And I love that kind of, I get that real energy from it. And I find it really empowering and knowing that I'm helping people. So I love that. But then don't knock on my door unless I know you're going to. You know? Mm. It's almost that there are so many rules around my behavior that it's really difficult for anyone to kind of understand that. You know, it's like, it's a joke that my husband and I have, and he's like, oh, new rules. And I'm like, no, they've always been the rules. I just haven't had to verbalize it before. And it's just, but it's not like I'm a dictator in our house. It's just like, I need it to be like this in order to be able to live comfortably. And it's just, I don't know, it's just often silly things like just put that thing away, or no, this is the way the jars face, because if the jars are facing a different way, then it just upsets my equilibrium, you know. And I think that's the kind of autism side that needs that. And it's why I'm a dab hand at a spreadsheet, because I love the comfort in the numbers, I love the system, but I have 463 ideas every hour. And I think that's the ADHD and the autism kind of mixing, you know? I like to think it's a positive.
Yeah, well, there's positives and negatives with all of these things, you know, and that's what I try and do in this podcast is, like, neurodiversity can be a superpower, and there are elements of it, but there are some difficult things, and I don't want to sugarcoat that. That's kind of, we're trying to get the mix. So that was, like, 2 or 3 years ago, when the ADHD and autism came into play and you got assessed and diagnosed. But when do you think ADHD and autism first became a part of your story, looking back to maybe childhood
from birth.
What would you say?
I mean, presumably, because it's not something you develop, right? It's something you're born with. But certainly I was I'm the youngest, only of two, but I'm the youngest. And I wasn't as interested in the academic world as my parents and my brother, who was a straight A student for everything. And I could do it, but I'm just not interested. And I can see now that it's because the way things are taught are just boring. It's boring. You know, I've never really enjoyed going to museums where there isn't some sort of level of interaction. Well, and so, you know, that there's kind of things like that. So I mean, I did fine at school, you know, did absolutely fine at school. But I didn't apply myself, but that's because I wasn't interested in a lot of it. And the topics were, you know, the subjects I chose weren't the right subjects, but I chose them because kind of that was the expectation. So I can see that was a real problem there. And I think the biggest issue for me, the biggest kind of catalyst, was when I left school, because whilst the subjects I chose and the way that they were taught didn't necessarily appeal to me, which I think is the ADHD side, the autistic side loved knowing where to sit, knowing where everyone was, knowing who I was going to eat my lunch with, you know, all that kind of routine, and your friendship group. There was a real safety in that. And when I left school, I didn't have that anymore. And yeah, it was not good. Let's just say that it was not good at all. And I think that's where, I mean, you know, my family probably say that I went off the rails or something, but I mean, hardly, but I mean, I got into a bit of bother, and it was just because I was trying to work out how on earth life worked. You know, it was, yeah. It was a really, and I talk, you know, I've said before that my 20s were not a huge amount of fun, I don't think, because part of me, the autistic side probably, was trying to do the career, bought a house at 21, really, really responsible stuff that I felt I was expected to kind of do, family's expectations. But the ADHD side meant I changed jobs every 6 months, got into all sorts of trouble, did loads of clubbing, did a bit of drugs, but not like major stuff, but you know, just kind of went a bit wild, and yeah, it was horrible. It was kind of, looking back, it was just a really, really unhappy time, which is not great for your early 20s.
No.
But yeah, don't have fond memories of that time, but I the diagnosis has helped me understand why, which I think is, I'm grateful for.
So why do you think you went wild? I mean, a lot of young people go wild, you know. It's not unheard of for people to go clubbing, and but it sounds as if you were seeking something through all of that, or you were using it. Do you think you were using it as a kind of almost like self-medicating almost, or was it something else? What was going on then?
I think it was the dopamine hit. You know, I've never been a big drinker, and you know, so taking drugs, blimey, I used to like sometimes take some speed if I went clubbing. It was hardly like problematic. However, it was so different from my family environment. We were quite square as well in our friendship group at school. So, you know, I was kind of the devil, if you like. You know, I was the one who did things, and I was never afraid to take risks. And I think it was because my family's quite well, you know, possibly autistic traits through all of them, but they're quite quiet and are quite structured and don't really let themselves go and don't feel talking about feelings and emotions and all that stuff. And I am an absolute mess of emotions all the time. So I think I was just trying to find an outlet for that, because I had no guidance, right? I had nobody who'd ever done anything different. Everybody in my family, my parents were both teachers forever. My brother had gone to uni and then done a PhD and, you know, done this really kind of traditional path. And I just didn't want to do any of that. And that was seen as a failing, but I can see now, it makes me really sad, because if I look at younger Libby and it's like, oh my God, why didn't someone just help her? Why didn't someone just sit down and support her? And, you know, why wasn't there some kind of guiding person. I mean, I don't know if anybody has these, but just somebody. Mm. I didn't feel that there was ever kind of an older figure who was there to support me. Not that my parents didn't love me, but they just were so different, you know. Yes, it's sad, and mm. it's all because of what goes on in my head, you know.
But that's lovely that you've got. It sounds like you've got a lot of compassion for that early Libby. You know, you look back and I think that's really important, because I went through a time of looking at younger Ian and not quite despising him, but just thinking, what a complete idiot. Through the ADHD diagnosis, I started to have a lot more compassion, because there was a reason why I struggled with certain things. You know, going back to school for you, and the fact that you didn't maybe apply yourself in the way that your parents wanted you to, and you know, it's not like it sounds like you didn't do like really badly.
No, not at all by most people's standards, I didn't get straight A's, which was a failure in my family.
So there was that, and then obviously, you know, going off the rails in your 20s. So it sounds like there was something about you weren't kind of you were worried about what your parents were thinking about you. Was there an element of guilt with this? I mean, what was going through your mind when it came to your parents, and did that almost feed into it more and make you more go off the rails, or what was happening?
Yeah, I mean, this is not an issue that has gone away. I'll just say that. You know, I'm in my late 40s, you know, and it's like I was diagnosed at 48. And yeah, I've had a lot of therapy about my relationship with my parents and expectations, and the fact that this is quite difficult for me to talk about and sort of talk about so publicly, because on the surface everything's fine, right? You know, we used to go to France for a month every summer, and you know, we kind of had everything that we wanted. There was never any arguments, you know. On the surface it was a nice middle class upbringing, but it didn't fit me. And so my feeling through my entire life, and it's only really, really recently that I'm actually kind of properly getting to the other side of this, is that I've just been a massive disappointment. I've just been a massive disappointment, which is awful, which is hard. And I wouldn't wish that on anybody, because it impacts everything. And I'm not a disappointment. I'm just very different to my family, you know. I just, I have this crazy kind of impulsive fun side, which I love, you know. I've just had the tattoo of a roller coaster done on my arm, and you know, of course that brought about lots of from my mother, you know. And it's like, well, I'm nearly 50, you know, who cares what you think? But inside, obviously I care massively, because it has a huge impact. But it's allowing myself to really be me and to let go of the judgment that is part factual and part perceived, right? You know, there's some truth to it, but also a lot of it's kind of it's my own sort of what I've made it be true. So it's a tough one. It's a tough one.
Yeah.
And because we're not a family that talks about how we feel, that's why I come on podcasts.
It's like a therapy session.
I would never say this to my parents, never in a million years, and they're highly unlikely to listen to this, but never say it to, but it's it's really hard to communicate, because there's a lot of kind of polite conversation, and it's just like, you know, you're kind of dying inside. So the whole thing makes me really, really sad. Yeah.
No, I'm sorry to hear that. It's a tough one when it comes to relationships with people close, who are close in our lives. And so that's your parents. How about yourself, though? Because often it can be ourselves that we're very judgmental of ourselves, and we can start to think, well, I'm a disaster. I'm no good. I'm a failure. How much has that been an issue for you, or is it mainly your perceived is your perception of other people's view of you. What's your perception of yourself, and how has ADHD and autism affected that, do you think?
I think the biggest thing with me, because I've done some really, really cool stuff, because I'm kind of not afraid to try things. You know, I've had some amazing jobs, and I've always worked, and I've always had really good jobs until I started my business in 2011. So, you know, I've always done really, really well in the workplace, even if it hasn't quite suited me. And I've got kind of all this evidence for it. But the thing that I've never felt is like satisfied or in the place that I should be. Do you know? It's always felt like I'm either trying to prove a point, or I'm trying to get to the next step, or I'm doing it because it's the right thing to do. That kind of stuff. And it really is only now. And that's absolutely goes for the first few years of my business, for sure. And it's only really in the last kind of 2 or 3 years, I guess, since I started exploring this other side, that I've thought, well, hang on, what do I really want? And oh, yeah, I can just do that. And if I'm weird, then fine, whatever, it's my own business. Let me behave as weirdly as I like, and people will come or they won't come. The same as if I was the most sensible person in the world, they would come or they wouldn't come. Okay? So it's a really interesting journey, and I have certainly been on a journey of self that I'm continuing to go on. Yeah.
Well, I think we're all on that. So that was your teens and your 20s. And then when you hit your 30s, everything became fine and normal, didn't it? Or not?
It was like, better.
So what happened? Because obviously that the 20s was like this emotional rollercoaster. Yeah. You were all over the place. You say things got better in your 30s and then into your 40s. Tell us a little bit more about what happened.
So every decade has got better. So, you know, I'm going to be turning 50 soon, which is, that's a head scratcher in itself. But so, you know, my 50s is going to be like the best decade, because it has got better each year. And part of that is because I'm just being way more me. You know, I'm masking, I suppose, but just recognising what it is that I really want from life. But when I was 24, I met someone and he was very kind of, I don't know, he was very good for me in that he was very sensible and kind of kind and all of this. And well, yeah, we got married when I was 28 and moved to a house, I was 27, I think, in a new development. And everybody was new, and there were lots of couples the same age. And I loved living there. I had a real comfort space living there. And I ended up living there for 15 years in that house. And I was really happy then. And work was much better. And I had a comfortable friendship group, and I won't say that there weren't the crazy things kind of happening, but I definitely felt a lot more settled until I started my own business. And I realized that I didn't want to be married to that person anymore, because I was moving on to bigger things, baby. And and so yeah, so that was like 39. Yes, I was 39 when we got divorced. And so that led to 3 years of, I mean, total derailment. Still had my business, but I made all my start. Well, you were there when I made the decision in America to make all my staff redundant and give up the office and everything. That was kind of a big thing. And part of that was my journey of self-discovery. That was 2015. And you know, the 3 years between husbands, I like to call it, was really difficult for me. And I met a girl who'd just split up with her husband. So we kind of became absolutely inseparable. And I was out a lot, and I drank more than I've ever drunk in my life, because I've not been a big drinker. And I would quite often not remember getting home, and, you know, scrape knees and have inappropriate or ill-advised relationships with people. And it was not great. It was not great. And during that time as well, I sold the house, because I'd bought my ex out. I sold my house because it was a lot to pay for on my own. Bought a much smaller house, and then got together with my current husband, and kind of everything settled down again. So it's been, whilst my 40s, there've been so much amazing stuff that's happened in my 40s, but I can see how that period of time was just like, whoa, I am lost, and I'm doing what I did in my early 20s, except perhaps with more fun involved, but the kind of almost self-destruction, but to try and find my place again. in life and the world. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. And this is one of the things with ADHD, particularly the emotional, I suppose it's called emotional dysregulation, where most people with ADHD are very emotional people. And it's like, what do you do with all that emotion? It's kind of got to go somewhere. But being diagnosed and knowing you have ADHD really gives you I think a vocabulary. We can understand what's happening. How has knowing that you have ADHD and autism, how has that changed the way you view your challenges and your strengths? Because as you said right at the beginning, you know, there are kind of good things and difficult things.
Yeah. Well, it's the good things, I think I've kind of always known that I'm good at them. So it's, you know, you just still accept that. It's like I'm really good at speaking on stage and I'm really good at motivating people, you know, all this stuff. And I kind of, when you're good at something, then you don't analyze it as much, right? So, but the other stuff, the, like if I'm going on a train somewhere and because I've got to be somewhere at a certain time and I get to the train station, the train's really delayed or the train is cancelled, I can absolutely lose it. I can have a proper meltdown because of that, because I can't cope with it. And that's, I've always been like that. And you kind of put it down as overdramatic or something. But now I know it's because of the way I'm wired. And so it's really helped in my relationship. I don't know if you found that since your diagnosis and the process that you guys have been through. But certainly I can phone my husband in like absolute floods of tears. I don't speak. And he can just know that it's part of the thing and I just need to get it out and then I'll be fine and it'll be gone and it'll be fine. But it's, yeah, so I think that's been really, really important to know that I'm not weak, I'm not a drama queen, I'm not attention seeking, it's just kind of the way I am, you know? And it's fine, it's just a quirk, right?
Yeah, it's the way your brain is wired and understanding, like, if you are phoning your husband in floods of tears, like, it's, there is a reason why it's not. Yeah. And actually, you are not alone in that. That, you know, it's just that we don't tend to see those kind of private moments. And that's interesting, you know, because in the past, you'd probably, I'm assuming, you tell me, tried to hold yourself together. There was a lot more of the masking that came into place. And I'm interested, I've looked at my own life and seen the moments that I've masked symptoms, particularly with ADHD. But I'm interested for you, how has that manifested itself with ADHD and also autism? And how less likely are you to mask these days? Are you finding that a liberating experience, masking less, or are you still doing that to an extent?
I think that we all do it to a certain extent, but I don't mind a little jig in the supermarket if the mood comes over me. You know, I'm kind of not bothered about that. And the stimming, I do some of it I've always done, but now my husband, we're kind of aware, he's always pointed stuff out to me way before my diagnosis. He's like, why do you hold your thumbs like this, you know, and what are you doing with your fingers? And that was more or less when we first got together, and of course now we know why. So it's just seen as a Libbyism. I think even the fact talking about this stuff has been very helpful to me, and it's also brought clients to me because I am open and honest, and it's like, well, I can't change it, so let me talk about it. To me, it's just it's another thing, like, right, I'm neurodivergent, I'm a woman, you know, these are all things, these are all kind of identifiers that we talk about and we share. So I don't look at it as a disability, which, you know, technically it is, but I'm really, really uncomfortable with that. But the time when I'm asked the most, and this will be of no surprise to you, is when I go and see my parents or my family, because then I have to revert back to the sort of well-behaved teenager or something. I don't know. Yeah, I don't behave as I would, you know. Yeah, as I would really want to.
It's a tough one, isn't it? But, you know, thinking about those Libbyisms or whatever you call them, it's those bits about you that, like, it's not going to be for everyone. There's going to be some people that will be put off by some of the things that you do. That's kind of, I think we need to get to a point where that's okay. Like, we can't be for everybody. But some people are going to love that. Some people are going to love your little quirks. And that's going to, you know, and we're talking about whether that's, you know, friends or in business. And people, when you're on camera and you're doing some Libyanisms, you know, that's something that I don't think we should be trying to hide. And I'm sure I have some of those too. And I think I've tried to mask those. And we're all trying to become some kind of normal, whatever that is. And yeah, it's that normal that is boring. And particularly as we get into this, more and more into this world of AI, and where everything becomes potentially artificial, I think we need this even more than ever. I think we need to embrace our weirdness, our inner weirdness. So I'm all for that. But do you think, you know, not talking particularly about your parents here, do you think there are moments when we do have to mask, there's certain situations that call for something? Or do you think there are other strategies that you've implemented to help you get through a situation? Because, you know, arguably masking is not a great solution to that. I don't know.
I think there are... It's really difficult because the last thing I want to do is sound ableist and squash me and the way we are and where I am and the squash you and the way you are. However, for those of us, and I'm still not really up on all the kind of terminology, but those of us that I believe are called kind of high functioning, neurodivergent people, is, you know, we know that when we're, in a meeting with the bank manager, you know, there's certain language that you choose to use, and you sit and you might kind of twitch, you know, for sure. You might like twitch your knees and all of this. It's you know, you don't get up and dance in the middle of that meeting. So that, I mean, maybe we should, right? Maybe that's something wrong there. But it's that is a level of masking, but I think that's a conscious behavior choice. It's really uncomfortable talking about this because, like I say, it just sounds horribly ableist, and I don't mean it like that, because I'm talking about myself too.
Yeah.
But yes, there are things like, you know, in the supermarket, and if there's a song playing and I'm like, that to me is unmasked, and I don't know, there's nothing wrong with that. But I know some people will say, well, that's not how you behave in a supermarket, and I'm like, as long as I pay for my groceries, I don't see why it matters. So it's about having the balance. And I think saying to people, I am autistic, I am ADHD, if it's going to make you feel more comfortable and enable you to not mask as much, then that's really important to do. You know, if there's concessions that you need, then ask for them, because this is not, there's no stigma attached to that, or increasingly less stigma, I guess. And so we have to almost take control of it ourselves and lead by example, because society is a bit slow to catch up sometimes.
It is an uncomfortable conversation in a way, but, and it, I think it's a really important conversation. In many ways, we've come so far. We're able to talk about neurodiversity, ADHD, autism, all these things, a lot more. But we live in the real world where not everyone gets it, and there are still misconceptions and stigmas. People don't understand it. We're going to be judged. You know, if I just let it all out, I may not get the job that I want. I may lose clients over it. And we can say, okay, well, that's tough luck. It's their problem, not mine. But we live in a real world where we've got mortgages to pay, and it's a tough one. Ultimately, I think, you know, we do have to think about our mental health, and we have to think about all of that. But it's a balance, isn't it? And so I wanted to ask you about misconceptions and stigmas. You yourself had them. I had them. You know, I remember talking about all these people with ADHD, they're just lazy and all that kind of, it's really bad. But I think so many of us back in those days, I'm talking about probably in the 90s and the early 2000s, we just didn't know very much. Things have changed now, but do you still think, are you still faced with misconceptions from other people or even yourself or stigmas about ADHD and autism? And how have you addressed those?
It was really interesting when I got diagnosed because I decided, so it's almost exactly, I don't know when this goes out, but it was, it's almost exactly a year since I was diagnosed with autism. And I made the decision almost straight away, well, probably too much, to like fully embrace it, you know, to talk about it and to tell people about it. And I was in a bit of a vulnerable state at the time because it was a lot to take on. So I told people probably too quickly. But a few people have said, well, you don't look autistic. And it's like, all right, okay, that old chestnut. And also, well, you can't be because all autistic, this guy I've known for years and years and years, and he said, I would never have guessed because autistic people talk like Daleks. And I'm like, what? What? And that's not what I've ever heard before. But and it was so strange and it was so unvalidating, whatever the opposite of validating is, because it was like, well, this is how I am. You wouldn't say that if I, and I'm not comparing the two, but you wouldn't say that if I said I'd just been diagnosed with cancer. I'm like, well, you don't look like you've got cancer. And I'm not saying they are the same thing. It's just the first thing that popped into my head. And sometimes those of us with ADHD, we say the first thing that comes into our minds and it's not always the most appropriate, but you understand, you understand what I'm trying to say. So it's just like, well, how am I supposed to look? What am I supposed to be doing? And that was really difficult. So that stigma still exists. But actually, for me now, a year on, almost exactly a year on from that diagnosis, I absolutely own this. And there isn't a talk that I'll do now where I won't mention it at least in passing. So a couple of weeks ago, I spoke on stage to nearly 300 people. And it's like, it was part of that. And actually, a few people came and spoke to me afterwards and said, yeah, that really resonated. And I just know that it kind of strikes a chord for people. So I am what I am, right? And sure, I wish I was a bit thinner and, you know, actually finished things sometimes and, you know, made £1 million while I was asleep and, you know, all these things that we kind of wish for. But ultimately, I'm me. I'm quite accepting of myself. I don't dislike myself. I'm quite kind of happy with myself. I've got a really loving, happy relationship. And, you know, that I'm all right, Jack, right? You know, kind of thing. That's
awesome. It's really awesome. And if I may say this, you know, since we've known each other for such a long time, you are so much... You seem to me so much more happy in yourself than when I first met you. And you're just happy to be who you are. And that's the most wonderful thing. And if we let other people's views of us cloud that, it's such a difficult thing. It's not going to help us. And it's interesting. So when you came out as ADHD, came out.
Told everyone my dirty secret.
that kind of made sense to me. And then the autism thing, I'll be honest, like I thought, oh, I get, I, you know, and if I, I'll, I'm going to come out with it. That's not what I would have thought. And the reason for that is I don't know anything about autism. Mm. And that... My view, and it wasn't just you. There was a few other people I know who have found out they're autistic, and I thought
we're everywhere now. You know,
that's really interesting, and we need. You know, I've done a lot of research into ADHD, and I understand not everything about it, but a lot about it, and that kind of struck me. I thought, okay, like Libby's a good friend of mine, and she's said she's autistic, and that's come as a bit of a surprise to me. What am I going to do about that? And so. It's something that I really want to learn much more about. And because I think so often people will, and maybe it's an ADHD thing, they just come out with it. So, oh, you're not autistic. you know, and so like how, Do you think it's really up to other people to do the stuff, or have you kind of, when people say to you, oh, I didn't think you were autistic, you know, do you have some kind of response to that, or do you just say, come on, get with it, educate yourself?
It hasn't happened for a while, actually. It was a very kind of early on thing with people I'd known for a long time. And I suppose you move and reshape your community, right? And being in the entrepreneurial community, and most of the people I talk to are business owners and all of that, everybody's like, yeah, me too, you know, whether they're diagnosed or not. It certainly identifies, particularly with ADHD. So it's almost like we're in the gang together. but it's... I've kind of forgotten the question, sorry.
It's all right, no, it was just like...
there's a pure example. It's like my thought process has gone another way, and I'm like, that's not what he said.
It was partly my problem, because I probably asked about five questions at the same time, so I will rephrase it. I suppose it's like when people say to you, when you say to people, I have ADHD and autism, and people come back with a slightly... oh, kind of response, oh, well, like, well, doesn't everyone have that? Or, you know, those kind of things. Or they come out with those kind of comments that would have probably really frustrated you in the past. What is your response these days?
Yeah, so we're all a bit ADHD is a really common one, isn't it? And it's like, yeah, well, we might be because you're all undiagnosed. And actually, neurodivergent is way more common than neurotypical. So then named the wrong things. So I kind of have that belief, I think, actually. But they're talking about the good stuff, right? They're talking about the kind of just not putting things away properly and not finishing stuff and being late and all of that, which are traits. But... It's the other stuff. And it's like, no, you don't actually live in my head, which last night, for example, was so noisy that I didn't go to sleep until nearly 2:30, which is insane. And my husband's alarm went off at 5:55. So that was a fun night. And it's that constant brain noise that I think is the most debilitating for me. Sure, there's the crying because your train gets cancelled and, you know, all the kind of seemingly silly stuff, or the fear of going outside because you don't know whether there's going to be someone else on the street and kind of stuff like that. But it's constant, and it's, you know, you've got a song playing in your head as well as a conversation from 4 years ago. And oh, you've just thought of your cracking line to give back to them, as well as planning what you're going to do with your business, as well as thinking, oh, I haven't replied to those emails, as well as the kind of audible noise of everything. And that is absolutely exhausting. And nobody can see that. But, you know, you're sitting there quietly. I do a lot of this. I sit there quietly, maybe even with my eyes closed. But I am busier than most neurotypical people will ever be in their entire lives, because it's all internal. And that's really tough. And that's hard to communicate to people. But then if people are not interested, really interested, I'm not going to waste my time bothering to try and explain any of it, you know, because it's like, yeah. I don't want to know about them. They don't want to know about me. Fine.
Yeah. No, makes sense. So it is something that has, when people have come out with those kind of things, I feel under pressure to have to then try and explain things. And I've come to the point now thinking, well, why am I spending all that time doing that? It's just not particularly helpful. But one way to do that is through this podcast and to have these kind of conversations. So this has been great. I want to ask you about, coming back to business, I suppose, is how has ADHD and autism influenced your creative process or your approach to entrepreneurship? You know, you've had what I kind of lovingly call proper jobs, and you've worked for yourself as well. I kind of jokingly say that, but how has that, yeah, tell us a bit about that, please.
It's been a blessing and a curse, but now I understand it, which I'm grateful for. So in my business, you've been in business for 13 years this year, and whilst I've always focused really on the same thing, which is helping business owners to you need to be more efficient and to make more money. That's been in 450 different guises, right? You know, there was social media training, and then there was like social media management, and then there's strategic consultancy, and then there's done for you ad stuff, and then and then there's in-person days, and then there's online days, and then, oh, I'll run a BTEC qualification. I mean, that was like, I'd only been in business about 6 months when I started doing that. And then, you know, and it's just like, it's really hard to explain my business journey, because it's like, I've done what? I've done all of those things. Yeah. And the ability to pivot is incredible, right? I think that that is a gift that we have, that tomorrow you and I could both, we could set up a business together and make it immediately successful, right? Because we've got the brain capacity and that push of energy to be able to do it. We probably would have run out of steam by Saturday though, because it's because the joy's in the creating, and you don't necessarily have that, the mental energy that it takes to sustain stuff. So whilst it's brilliant because I have all these ideas for my own business, it's kind of a curse, because I launch things and unlaunch things, and I'm far better now. I have recognize this and put parameters in place to stop me doing that and take a much slower journey in my pivots. But it makes me an absolutely fantastic business coach. And I say that without any kind of massive ego about it, because I know it's true, because there is so much in my head that, and I've worked with like 6,500 business owners since I started, that there's hardly an issue, an emotion, a mindset challenge, a problem, conundrum that they can't bring to me, that I can't solve for them or reframe for them, because of all the experience I've got and because of everything I collect along the way. You know, our brains are just like, they're bigger than sponges, whatever bigger than a sponge is. It's like, you know, there's so much information. We're like our own AIs, right? Because there's so much information in there, and you don't even know that conversation you overheard 10 years ago is going to be needed today, but there it is, it comes out. And I think that, you know, that I absolutely love that about my brain. I love its ability to be able to do that, and I talk about it in kind of in the third person almost, but yeah, the inability to stick at stuff, the shiny object, the wanting to do something different is the hard balance of that, I suppose.
Of course. So, like, what are the strategies and tools that you've learned in managing your ADHD and autism symptoms? Now, not all of these necessarily have to be good. Sometimes we learn bad strategies, which kind of come back to bite us. So I don't know whether you've inadvertently learned those over the years. And, you know, you mentioned the whole kind of high functioning thing. I think this is a particular issue with those of us in that category, whatever the word is in the phrase, and I can't work out what the right phrase is for that. But those of us who have had success in our businesses, we've probably learned certain strategies that are bad and good. Have you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that I've learned over the years, and actually, really, if I'm being absolutely honest, I've probably only really implemented it in the last year or so. So I talk like I'm seasoned at this, but no, I struggle with this stuff every day. You know, I'm exceptional at helping other people, but I mean, this is chaos, right? My desk is chaos. Well, it's not too bad, but it's what you say and what comes out is not necessarily what you're able to do yourself. cobbler's shoes and all that, But one strategy that I implement, and I've talked about this in my own podcast, and I talk about this with my clients, is about kind of sitting on things. So having the ideas is incredible, right? And that fires us up and that gives us enthusiasm for life as much as business. And we can plan them out and we can write it down, and then we can just leave it for 48 hours. And if we still have any enthusiasm, if we even still remember what was so brilliant about it, if that kind of fire is still there, then act on it. But what I always used to do was have these amazing ideas, create the website, create the funnel, launch the thing, get people to sign up, and the next day go, oh no, I don't want to do that anymore. And I can think of two examples of when I've launched and then unlaunched. And it's a horrible, horrible roller coaster to be on that. It's a really tough roller coaster to be on. So sitting on stuff and not doing anything with the idea for 48 hours is a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant tactic. And in terms of kind of bad, not bad things, but things don't, that you might beat yourself up for not doing, is like batching content. And I've talked about batching content a lot. You know, I've taught social media for years, right? Batching content's always a thing. Batching content's really hard because you've got to be in the right frame of mind to write the content in the first place. So it's not necessary. And if you're not doing it, or you do it for a bit and then you don't do it, it's like you're beating yourself up, but actually you're not giving yourself the kindness of understanding how it is that your brain works. So just do what you need to do, you know, as long as you've got a plan, then things like that are perhaps too literal. I think that's the thing, because there is absolutely a place for batching content, even if it's just like collating your images and this kind of stuff. But there's ways that you can interpret it. But if we take everything literally, it's a bit difficult. It can be a bit difficult. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. So like, since you were diagnosed and you understand a lot more about yourself, what was the next stage, you know, in terms of, it was the understanding. Have you implemented any new things in your life, whether that's been your personal life or your business life? You know, what things have you put into place that have helped you?
Well, first of all, I went into burnout, I think. took some time off a couple of months later. We met up, I think, last July or August, when I needed to take some time off, because it was just all a lot to process. And I was still trying to charge at 100 miles an hour, and I just realized that I couldn't do that anymore. So I'm much more mindful of my energy levels, and I've talked about this for years. However, now I am genuinely much more mindful of my energy levels. And so my business has continued to kind of shape itself after the over the last year or so into something that really, really suits me. And, you know, we often in business, we talk a lot about our clients and how we're going to serve our clients and the transformation we get for our clients and what our client needs. And it's like, yeah, but hang on a minute, it's your business. What do you need first and foremost? What do you, you know, what's your, what do you call it? Oxygen mask, you know, where's yours? And the business has to suit you. So the changes that I'm implementing now is as few Zoom calls in my diary as possible, because they're really, really tiring. I know they're easy to do, but they're really draining and they're really tiring. And only going to the events that I know are going to be good, or there's interesting people there, you know, making a conscious decision about the events I go to, not just going to everything, and not giving into FOMO just because everyone else is going. But, you know, you've got an event the day afterwards, you don't have to do it all. So making those changes and phasing out some of the type of work that I've done for a long time, which is one-to-one. I've always done it. And I love it in the moment because it gives that dopamine hit and I can make a big difference to the clients. But it's tiring. You know, it's really, really tiring. And I have to, and I'm not getting any younger, so I have to be really mindful of that. And moving back into a group coaching kind of model, because it has to be sustainable for me. And I don't want to have to keep pivoting my business because something's not sitting right in my business, because I am tired of doing that.
Yeah, I get that. For me, I've done things like I've had like assistants in my business for years, but I've then realized how much I need that in my life. And I've been looking at kind of more holistic ways of treating my ADHD. Personally, at the moment, I haven't gone down the medication route, but I might do in the future. I have, you know, I think you mentioned therapy as well. That's helped, and I've had coaching. There have been anything like that that's made a big impact and have really helped you with your ADHD and autism?
Yeah, two things immediately spring to mind. One is EFT. Tapping, emotional freedom technique. I've been having that on and off for probably about 3 years. And it really, really helps me deal with, I have it monthly at the moment. I'm in a kind of six month program of having it one-to-one. And it really helps me to just, I don't know, quiet my mind a bit. And the stuff that niggles and the RSD, when that crops up, and the stuff that I do beat myself up for, it helps me rationalise that. And also it helps me reframe all the stuff that I'm carrying through from my childhood and the disappointment thing and all that stuff, and be more, measured about it and truthful about it, rather than what I think is actually going on. So that's always been...
Do you just want to explain? So you mentioned RSD. That's rejection sensitivity dysphoria. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah.
Maybe explain that and also a little bit more about, I mean, it's really interesting because we talked about EFT last time, and we were talking about, like, that's quite a woo-woo thing, and I always have a woo-woo detector, but I've heard quite a few people talk about this, and it's one of those things that it might sound a bit woo, but I've heard it really does work, and maybe kind of explain a little bit more about what it is and why it works for you.
Okay, I don't know why it works for me, because I'm not a woo person at all, right? So some of this stuff I'm like, okay, I just have to not understand it, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But the practitioner that I use, she's Canadian, so I've never met her, but she's one of my dearest friends. We met on Instagram three or so years ago, and fantastic. And she calls herself woo adjacent, right, which I quite like, because she's very practical and very scientific in her approach, but obviously there's this kind of, like, you know, je ne sais quoi with it too. And I think, I don't know if it's the tapping itself, because you tap in certain places kind of on your face and say stuff or repeat stuff while you're tapping. I don't know if it's that helps, or just being in the space where someone is reframing something for me. So I don't actually know which bits work, but I know that working with Jackie Akuri, who I work with, I know that she is good for me, right? So it's kind of difficult to quantify it more than that, but it's at looking at things differently that is really, 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 really helpful. And we do a lot of visualization, and I have the world's most vivid imagination, probably because I'm autistic. And so I find that really helpful to just reframe scenarios that I can think of in the past that I'm still carrying with me, that, you know, just are rubbish and I don't need that stuff in my life. And the RSD, the rejection sensitive dysphoria, ooh, that's not fun. I mean, that just is not fun. I don't know if it impacts you much. Yeah. It's horrible, right? So it the feeling of being a total failure and everybody hating you, right? Everybody in the whole world will feel that at some point. But this is like, you really believe that is true. And you're a waste of space, you're a waste of time, nobody cares whether you're here or not. You know, it can be really kind of quite extreme feelings, but not necessarily for long. You know, this can be a few hours in the afternoon, or you wake up feeling like that, and by lunchtime, because you've sat at your desk and you've done something, you feel all right again. So it doesn't stick around for long with me, but when it happens, it's horrible. It's the worst thing, because it frightens me. You know, it really, really frightens me, feeling like that, because I know it not to be true, but oh my goodness me, I believe it in the moment.
And it's because we're very emotional people that that is a deep emotion, and so it's very difficult not to believe it, even though your brain's saying that's not true. Like, I'm not a complete disaster. I have had some successes in my life, but I feel like a complete fraud and an idiot. And I'm, you know, it's not a nice feeling. So, but it's cool that you've found ways and strategies that help. And so, if you're watching and listening, and you're a little bit kind of dubious about some of these things, it might be that EFT isn't for you. That's fine. There'll be other things, but it's finding strategies that are going to work for you.
There's something else that I had very, very recently that is worth me just talking about, because I didn't know what it was. So I met someone at an event, and she talked to about, she's a, I don't really know what kind of therapist, but like a sort of woo therapist. But she's very practical in the way she talks. And she told her story and said she'd, you know, how she helped people and all that. I just thought, oh, I think that's what I need next. You know, kind of about being more open, being more heart-based and less head-based. Mm. And I thought that, I think that could be an interesting shift for me. So I had a session with her and she did something where I was just lying on the bed and it was lovely and comfy and all of this. And she just had her hands on my head in various spots like this. And afterwards, as I was walking back to the train station, my brain was quiet. And it was the weirdest, weirdest feeling because my brain is never quiet, not even when I'm asleep because my dreams are so vivid. And it was just, and that therapy, I suppose, was called access bars. And I'd never heard of it and I'd never experienced it. And I sort of went, not even, still not knowing what it was called. But it was absolutely incredible. And it is used by psychiatrists, but it's used by medical people too. So that was quite comforting because anything that's, forest bathing or something makes me feel a bit weird. So, but yeah, it's got a kind of scientific side to it too. But I was like, whoa, this is must be what it's like for other people. Just quiet.
Yeah. Yeah, that must be weird. I don't think I've had that before. But it's interesting. There's a book which I only partly read. This is, again, an ADHD problem because I would love to kind of have so many books I would love to read and I start them. But book by, is it Ned Halliwell, who is author of, it's really, really co-author of this really good book called Driven to Distraction, which is kind of like the Bible of the ADHD world. And the book that he wrote is called ADHD 2.0, and it's all about more holistic approaches, ways of helping ADHD. And some of the things that they've talked about are balancing, like practicing your balancing. Like, this is why things like Pilates is really good, because apparently you're working on your cerebellum, which is the back of the brain, I believe, which is kind of, I'm going to sound like I know what I'm talking about, which I don't really, but apparently that is kind of connected to the prefrontal cortex, which is what so many of us with ADHD struggle with, that the prefrontal cortex is not as developed. And so apparently that can really help activate the prefrontal cortex a little bit more. There's some science with all of this stuff. It's really interesting. And it's having ADHD and autism and all that kind of stuff, there are pros, there are cons, there are strengths, there are weaknesses, however you want to frame it. But it is a good time to be alive in terms of there's a lot more research, a lot more we're learning about this and more better strategies, I think. If you went back to the 1800s or the 1900s, arguably the world that we were living in might have been a little bit kinder to those of us with ADHD, but there certainly wouldn't have been the knowledge about it. And so that wouldn't have been good. I think, Libby, that's been, it's been so amazing hearing your story. I'm sure we could have gone into more detail, but I think we'll leave it there. It's been really, really interesting and a real privilege. So thank you so much for being so honest and open. Is there anything finally that you'd like to share with people who have listened to your story and it's made an impact on them? What's your hope for people who are listening? How would you encourage them in their journey? Maybe they've struggled with some of the things that you've struggled with. What's your kind of final thoughts on that?
I mean, I think just, you know, to reach out to, and say, do you know what? This sounds like me. That I get messages every time I do one of my own podcasts or talk about it. I get messages from people, and I find it really heartwarming that people do that. And me, talking about myself and my life has had an impact on people and made them realise that actually they're not going mad. You know, they're not a disappointment. There's just something different about their brain, and that's okay. I find it really empowering to empower other people. And I assume you're exactly the same, the reason why you started this podcast. Mm. And so, yeah, I would encourage people to message me, to message you, to actually just put the words to to phone to paper, and kind of come out, as you said earlier, that you think you might be, because that's the start of the journey. And then you can join some Facebook groups, and then you can connect with other people, and you'll soon find that you're absolutely not alone, because we're everywhere, and it makes life just so much easier. But you know, if one person has listened to this and has thought, wow, yeah, that's me, then that's brilliant. I'd be absolutely delighted with that. I mean, obviously, yeah. I hope that loads of people listen to it, right? But I mean, about impact.
Yeah. Well, it's a new podcast, so we're starting small, but the aim is to reach more and more people. So if you have been touched by this episode and what Libby's saying and Libby's story, please do get in touch. You can post comments, of course, if you're watching on YouTube, or get in touch via my email, which is ian@smartadhd.me. And of course, we're across all the socials as well. But if you would like to get in touch with Libby, how's the best way of people getting in touch with you?
Instagram is probably the best way. So I'm at Libby Langley on Instagram. If LinkedIn is your preference, I'm Libby Langley on there. And if you want to hear more of me talking about my business story and kind of business support for people with neurodiversity, then my podcast is called Life in Business, and it comes out every week. And I know that it does help people who are just like us.
And you know, it's great hearing you talk about your podcast, because you clearly love it, you're passionate about it, and I know from what you've said that people really do find it so helpful. So do check out Libby's podcast and follow her on the socials, and do reach out, because we're wanting to make an impact on you watching and listening, but it means so much to us. I don't want to speak for you, Libby, but I assume you're the same, that when we actually hear from you watching and listening, if it has made an impact, do let us know, because it makes it makes our day. It really does. So awesome. Well, thanks, Libby. It's been great to have you on. I really appreciate it. But we are out of time for this week. We'll be back with another episode next week. We're doing just a combination of different things. It's either me speaking on a topic, have an expert on, or another person with another smart ADHDer telling their smart ADHD story. But until next time, toodaloo.